From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the terrorist threat is called severe, complex, and evolving. What can be done to help control violent extremism?
When grievances aren't resolved in a peaceful manner, well, then there lies the opportunity for other actors to insert themselves into those spaces and to foment discontent and potentially violence.
Pakistan reportedly bans the Haqqani terrorist network, and the WHO says millions of people die prematurely from non-communicable diseases. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. British Prime Minister David Cameron says Britain faces a severe threat of terrorist attack, while a European law enforcement official describes the security environment as difficult. VOA's Victor Beatty reports a U.S. lawmaker also warns of a growing threat of homegrown violent extremism.
Appearing on the CBS program Face the Nation Sunday, British Prime Minister David Cameron says Britain faces a severe threat, saying an attack is highly likely.
This threat keeps morphing because it's the same fundamental problem, extremist Islamist terror. The threat has changed and altered, but it's still based on the fundamental problem of a poisonous death cult narrative, which is the perversion of one of the world's major religions.
Mr. Cameron says the struggle against these extremists will take a long time and require international cooperation.
If we take the issue of Islamist extremist terrorism coming out of Iraq and Syria, it is going to take a very long time to deal with this, where we'll have to show real perseverance. We cannot do this on our own as Western countries. We need functioning government in Iraq, functioning government in Syria, to be the legitimate authorities that, with us, help to stamp out this perversion of the Islamic religion.
The director of the European Union's law enforcement agency, Europol, Rob Wainwright, says a determined police response is underway in the wake of the January 7th and January 9th terrorist attacks in France that killed 17 people.
We've seen action now in Belgium, in Greece, in Berlin, other locations as well. And it shows, I think, the nature of the threat that we're facing right now. It's spread across so many European countries, perpetrated by a community of possibly thousands of people who have been radicalized on the internet by their conflict experience in Syria and Iraq, and who have, many of them have returned to European society, perhaps some of them with the intent and capability to carry out the attack.
In an appearance on the ABC program this week, Wainwright says it is not just the scale of the problem police are facing, but the nature of the threat has changed since the September 11th, 2001 attacks in the United States. He says there is no clear command and control structure. However, he says there is a concerted effort underway for greater cooperation among counterterrorism services, including the sharing of intelligence and the tracking of terrorist financing, illicit firearms, and the monitoring of terrorist activities online. Also appearing on Face the Nation, Senate Intelligence Committee member Marco Rubio says, along with the external threat, the United States faces the potential of attack from homegrown violent extremism.
And what's made it more interesting, of course, and more dangerous is that, in fact, some of these individuals that are plotting these attacks may not even have traveled to the Middle East. They've been radicalized in a local mosque or online, and they've received instructions and or inspiration about how to carry out these attacks in the West from online platforms. So I think that's a very real risk for Europe, which is closer to the Middle East and has large immigrant populations from that region. But it's a real risk here in the United States, a country where every single year millions of people visit, travel to, immigrate to.
In an appearance on the NBC program Meet the Press, Senator Lindsey Graham, a member of the Armed Services Committee, insists the Islamic State group and al-Nusra Front in Syria and Iraq remain the biggest threats to the United States. He says success against them would change the landscape of the security threat worldwide. Greg Barton, director of the Monash University Center of Islam in the Modern World, says a tipping point was reached when the IS group captured the Iraqi city Mosul and called on its allies to launch lone wolf attacks wherever they are.
Quite separate to that, we have ongoing concerns with Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the situation in Nigeria and surrounding Cameroon goes from bad to worse. That doesn't project beyond the region at this point, but it does remind us that together with the problems in Somalia and Kenya with al-Shabaab, that we're facing increasing challenges on all fronts. And that, at the very least, that calls on international resources and stretches those resources thin at a time when it's increasingly hard to know which turn developments will take.
Barton says al-Qaeda has been around for 30 years, and with newer groups on the scene, he agrees with Prime Minister Cameron that a solution to terrorism is decades away. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Violent extremism results in death, maiming, terror, chaos, destruction, and sometimes the displacement of hundreds of people. And extremists are emboldened and ruthless as at a time, any time in recent memory, according to Michael Stanisic. He is head of International Relief and Development Stability and Governance Practice, which aims to counter extremism around the world. We asked what has contained extremism in the past to some degree.
Wow, I think that's a loaded question, actually, and one which really has, we have to look back at the history of how we approached our foreign assistance. And primarily it was contained because borders were far easier to control and information wasn't as widespread or as accessible as it is now. And so the interconnected nature of our world has diminished borders, even in instances where leaders may not want to do so, which has caused more fluidity and the ability to cross borders around the world.
And this has all got to do with the rule of law, doesn't it?
To some degree, rule of law, but there are plenty of socioeconomic issues that could be present. It could be a rule of law, a breakdown of rules and norms in societies, a lack of enforcement efforts to enforce laws that are in place. But the key element here is that all of these things start at the very ground level of the places where we work, and so it's community by community, and it's really grievances-based types of issues. And so when communities don't have the ability to resolve their grievances or disputes in a manner which is accepted by the whole, then you have opportunities for other actors to interject themselves into the dialogue.
Is it also a matter of having an opportunity? Some of these extremists, they don't seem to be coming from places where they have opportunities for their future.
Yes, I think that's a large a component of what we're dealing with and seeing globally. It's come to the fore more because we have access to this instantaneous information, and so with all this information at the fingertips of individuals and oftentimes without the resources to act internally to where their homes are and their home countries are, they look outside to either put the blame on individuals or groups or countries, and it serves as a recruitment tool to some sorts.
What kind of programs might help in controlling extremism or curtailing it?
It depends on where we're talking about. We can go back to the history of development, but I don't know that we need to devolve into that so much. But looking at how we're able to be proactive in our programming now with the understanding that in 10, 20, 30 years, it's going to reap the fruits of what we're doing. And so when you look at the term countering violent extremism, it serves as an indicator that violent extremism exists. And so I would prefer that we start taking a more proactive approach to that and understanding the grievances at these local levels in advance of violent extremism fomenting.
Well, what is your organization doing to try to help curtail violent extremism?
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. We're focused significantly on community mobilization activities around the world, and so we engage with communities at the point of departure. And for example, in the Sahel, we're running a three-country program, which is looking at disaffected youth, women, and empowering them, giving them the tools and resources to potentially mitigate conflict. And this can take any number of shapes or forms. For example, there's a participatory theater mechanism which has been used not only by IRD but others, and it's a very effective way to reach out to communities in rural areas with high levels of literacy. And so these are communities which are really driven by the word of mouth, and so when you're able to engage in that platform, you're able to essentially counter narratives of those extreme elements that are working in those spaces as well.
And you're seeing results.
Yes, but this is not a quick fix. And though countering violent extremism is kind of the new term that's being thrown about, the problems remain constant and have been the same for eternity. Essentially, when grievances aren't resolved in a peaceful manner, well, then there lies the opportunity for other actors to insert themselves into those spaces and to foment discontent and potentially violence.
Michael Staninich, head of International Relief and Development Stability and Governance Practice. He's author of the report, Fragile States, Violent Extremism Pressures Rules Based in International System. Pakistan has banned the feared Haqqani Network, a militant outfit allied to the Afghan Taliban. But officials cite unexplained complications for Islamabad's reluctance to formally announce the decision. Ayaz Ghul reports the government has come under criticism for the prevailing ambiguity and confusion surrounding the ban.
Government officials told VOA the decision to ban the Haqqani Network will be formally announced at an appropriate time, but did not provide details. Officials say the move is one outcome of the talks that U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held with Pakistani leaders during his visit to the country last week. Pakistani authorities are also linking Kerry's visit with the U.S. decision last week to designate the fugitive leader of the outlawed Pakistani Taliban, Mullah Fazlullah, as a global terrorist. They say the Haqqani Network ban is part of the so-called National Action Plan that Pakistan launched to intensify counter-terrorism efforts since the December 16th militant raid against a school in Peshawar that killed 150 people, mostly children. The school assault was the deadliest terrorist attack in Pakistan's history and led to an outpouring of grief and rage across the country. Addressing a gathering in Islamabad attended by foreign diplomats Monday, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif reiterated his counter-terrorism resolve.
The government is determined, fully determined to wipe out terrorism in all its shades and hues and has adopted a zero-tolerance policy against terrorists. We will leave no stone unturned to make sure that all areas of Pakistan are cleansed of all kinds of terrorists, militants and violent extremists.
The Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, an alliance of anti-state militant groups collectively known as the Pakistani Taliban, claimed responsibility for the school bloodshed in revenge for the killing of its non-combatants in army operations against the extremist group. The extraordinary school assault has led the government and military to rapidly strengthen and expand counter-terrorism actions. Since the attack, authorities have reinstated the death penalty, intensified the already ongoing anti-insurgency offensives in the tribal areas, and created military courts to try civilian terrorism suspects. Pakistan has hanged 20 people convicted of previous terrorism charges since the school attack. Officials say 500 more convicted terrorists are being processed for execution. Pakistan has long been under criticism for allowing anti-Afghan and anti-India Islamist militants to operate on its territory and for targeting only those extremists that are attacking the Pakistani state. However, Pakistani civilian and military leaders insist that the so-called good and bad Taliban policy has been abandoned. Prime Minister Sharif discussed the issue in his Monday address.
Pakistan will neither allow anyone to use its territory against any other country, nor would tolerate if terrorists use foreign soil for the terrorist activities in Pakistan.
Afghan and U.S. officials have long alleged that key Haqqani leaders used sanctuaries in Pakistan for plotting high-profile attacks in Afghanistan. They also have said the network allegedly received support from the Pakistani military spy agency, the ISI. Besides attacking Afghan and U.S. targets, critics say the network has worked to curb Pakistan rival India's influence in Afghanistan. Islamabad flatly denies any links or support for the group. Even though the ban on the Haqqani network and several other groups known for links to the Pakistani military has not been officially announced, the United States has gone ahead and welcomed the reported move. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mary Herf.
This is an important step toward eliminating terrorist activity in Pakistan. Obviously, the secretary was just there and had a wide-ranging conversation with the Pakistanis about counterterrorism. Certainly, he emphasized the work committed to deepening our security partnership with Pakistan.
The Afghan Taliban reacted to the Haqqani ban with indifference, reflecting its long-standing insistence that the insurgency does not rely on the support of sanctuaries in Pakistan. Taliban spokesman Zabiullah Mujahid said Mr. Haqqani and his Mujahideen very much live inside the country. He added that they do not move out of Afghanistan and maintain no contact with outsiders. While Pakistan focuses on the military's moves to harden counter-terrorism policies and control the volatile tribal areas, critics say the forceful measures are not needed. Human rights advocate Tahira Abdullah says the answer to Pakistan's terrorism problems lies in gathering the political will to implement the country's existing laws.
It is not the time to make new policies. It is the time to implement the laws of Pakistan that exist against terrorism and against hate speech and hate literature and all those who believe in extremist, militant Islam. We have laws, we have policies. We lack the political will and the commitment.
Abdullah and other critics of the counter-extremism efforts believe that without reforming and regularizing thousands of Islamic seminaries called madrasas, attempts to neutralize militant and sectarian outfits will not be productive. Some of these religious schools, even government officials admit, attract extremist outfits for new recruitments. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Friday, we reported that recent opinion polls are showing a large percentage of Americans favor at least limited military operations against the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. This indicates a change of heart. Shelby Telhami, a scholar with Brookings Institution, spoke further about the subject with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Following the recent massacre carried in Paris by Frenchmen who got trained in the Middle East, is the American public concerned about Americans joining ISIL to come back and carry attacks on the American soil?
When we did our poll, it was, of course, before the tragic attacks in Paris. But nonetheless, we did ask questions about how worried Americans are about other Americans joining ISIS and carrying attacks on American soil. And we find, actually, that almost half of the American public is at least somewhat worried about Americans joining ISIS and carrying out attack in the U.S. And although only about 12% are very worried. But still, it's clearly something that they're concerned about. And my suspicion is that the attacks in Paris probably raised that level of concern. But just to put it in some perspective in terms of comparison, we also ask, is your concern about Americans joining ISIS and carrying attacks in the U.S. greater or lesser than your fear for Americans joining Al-Qaeda? And what we find is that slightly less than Al-Qaeda. So while it is an expressed concern, it converges very close to the worry about Al-Qaeda, but not identical.
Did your survey of American public attitudes toward ISIL detect any perception of a correlation between the escalation of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the potential ability of ISIL to recruit fighters?
You know, one of the things that we tried to do is, particularly after Secretary of State Kerry in one statement with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, had said that something along the lines of violence on the Israel-Palestine issue could be used by ISIS to recruit or to enhance its power. And I know he got a lot of political criticism, so we decided to put a question on that in the survey, trying to see whether the American public believed that violence on the Israeli-Palestinian issue is likely to be used by ISIS to enhance its recruitment and focus more attention against the U.S. and Israel, or whether the two issues are totally independent, that ISIS will do what it will do regardless of the Israel-Palestine question. And the answers were interesting because we find that actually two-thirds of the American public thinks that there is linkage, that Israel-Palestine really fuels ISIS. And we also find, interestingly, that among Republicans, there's even more such belief, that over 70% of Republicans actually think that violence on the Israeli-Palestinian front would be used by ISIS to enhance its power and focus attention on the U.S. So clearly, I think the general attitude in the American public is that there is linkage for sure.
University of Maryland and Brookings Institution scholar Shelby Telhami. The World Health Organization says 16 million people under the age of 70 are dying prematurely every year from non-communicable diseases. A new report is calling for action to reduce these largely preventable deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Non-communicable diseases are the leading cause of death worldwide, accounting for 63% of all yearly deaths. The World Health Organization reports millions of people are dying prematurely from four major types of illnesses: heart and lung diseases, stroke, cancer, and diabetes. WHO cites tobacco use, the harmful use of alcohol, unhealthy diets, and physical inactivity as the four major risk factors, and notes embracing healthier lifestyles can significantly reduce these premature deaths. The lead author of the report, Shanti Mendis, is WHO coordinator for chronic diseases prevention and management. She calls non-communicable diseases a slow-motion public health disaster.
We are losing 16 million people every year in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, not in their 80s and 90s. And we are losing 38 million from NCDs overall every year. Out of the 16 million people who die under the age of 70, who are in their productive years, 82% are in low and middle income countries, which don't have the capacity to really address them.
In 2013, the World Health Assembly approved a global action plan that aims to reduce the number of premature deaths from non-communicable diseases by one quarter by 2025. The plan includes 9 voluntary global targets to tackle key risk factors. The report describes inroads being made by several countries that are implementing some of these strategies. For example, it notes smoking rates in Turkey have declined by 13% since the government increased the size of health warnings on tobacco products and increased taxes. While such progress is encouraging, WHO finds most countries are not on track to meet the 2025 goal. Dr. Mendis says many lives could be saved if countries implement a few low-cost strategies. These include a ban on all forms of tobacco advertising, replacing trans fats with polyunsaturated fats, restricting or banning alcohol advertising, and promoting healthy diets and physical activity. She tells VOA another serious problem that must be tackled is obesity in young children. She says 42 million children under age 5 are overweight and 5 million are obese. She says this is frightening because behaviors that are learned at a very young age are set for life.
Obesity contributes to so many comorbidities. What do I mean that? What I mean by that? If you're obese, you are more prone to develop high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, arthritic complaints, cancer, among other diseases. So you are set to develop chronic diseases in later life. What is really, again, alarming is in the last couple of years, the rise in obesity is highest in some African countries. The actual levels may be low now, but the rising trend is remarkable in those countries.
The World Health Organization says a small investment equal to $1 to $3 per person per year could dramatically reduce illness and death from NCDs. Globally, this amounts to $11.2 billion a year. That may sound like a lot until it is compared with the cost of doing business as usual in low- and middle-income countries. The WHO estimates from 2011 to 2025, cumulative economic losses in those countries due to NCDs will amount to $7 trillion. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also go to the Programs tab and listen to me one more time. I would enjoy that. Okay, I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.